Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All Things Therapy with Lisa Tahir, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Things Therapy. I'm your host, Lisa Tahir. I'm a licensed clinical social worker practicing as an intuitive psychotherapist. You can find me online through my website, which is nolatherapy.com. It's the abbreviation for New Orleans, Los Angeles Therapy. From my website, you're able to schedule sessions to meet with me in person or remotely. You're able to listen to archived episodes of this show. Please subscribe to this show through the links available to iTunes and Google Play. And I welcome you and thank you in advance for supporting my show through the crowdfunding campaign I have with Patreon.com. And you're able to take advantage of discounted offers available through the affiliate links that are listed. Today's show is brought to you by Audible, where there are over 180,000 book titles to choose from. And they offer you to try a 30-day trial with a free audiobook download by going to audibletrial.com/allthingstherapy. So today's a really special show for me. Many of you know that besides being a therapist, I'm a professional glass artist, and I got my start from the gentleman that I am interviewing today. In moments, we're going to be with Professor Gene Koss. He founded the Tulane Glass Art Department in 1976 and has taught and inspired tens of thousands of students. Many of them have gone on to be leaders in their own right within the glass art world. Gene holds the Maxine and Ford Graham Chair in Fine Arts at Tulane, and his career spans 41 years, and he's credited with the development of a glass casting technique that really has taken glass off the pedestal into the sculptural medium and material of in a monumental scale. His pieces are 3 to 8 tons, combined mixed media, glass and steel, and he's pioneered a casting technique that where you ladle molten glass into steel molds and use torches to keep them from cracking. This was not happening before Gene developed this process. And because of his contributions, he is a major influence in contemporary sculpture in America and around the world. Gene has exhibited in 50 one-man shows, 245 group shows, and he's conducted 89 workshops and lectures worldwide, including in Italy, at Urban Glass New York, Penland, North Carolina, Pilchuck Glass School in Stanwood, Washington, and Toyama City Institute of Glass in Japan. Gene is in major museum collections and private collections around the world. He's received multiple grants from the NEA. He's been interviewed on NPR, WYES, WLAE. He's been published in over 150 articles and books, including Who's Who in American Art. He's represented by Arthur Roger Gallery and has been since the 1980s when the gallery was in New York City and now is located in New Orleans, Louisiana. Gene himself got his start at Tyler School of Art from Temple University in Philly, where he started in ceramics and moved into glass. So we're going to talk about that, as well as his influence on contemporary American sculpture, his book coming out in 2018, and his prolific career. It's my honor, Gene, to have you on today. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Lisa. I appreciate it. I'm excited for being on your show. I've been looking forward to it.
Thank you. So I wanted to start by asking you, did you ever imagine that you would be where you are today when you started as a young artist?
Well, that's a good question. You really don't know where it's going to take you. I pinch myself all the time with a world-class studio at Tulane now, where we started really, really small, a real bohemian studio out back, or started with $5,000 from a grant from Pace McConte, out of Texas, Margaret Wilson. We're really fortunate. But I always had my eye on the ball. I guess if you find something you really love and passionate about, and it's all I wanted to be as a sculptor, and I saw people like Peter Boulkos's studio in the Dome at that time in L.A., and then studying at Tyler School of Art, where serious artists would come out of New York, come down and teach for 2 days, go back on a train. So I was around some pretty heavy influences as a young artist, and I always wanted to be, I wanted to do something that was, I thought, to push the envelope. And so I always looked at other people. If you're going to make good art, you got to look at good art. So I think there's a lot of influences, a lot of mentors, I guess.
So that's exactly what I wanted to ask you next, Gene, that knowing that you grew up on a farm in Wisconsin, how the farm and that landscape has influenced your sculpture, and how did you get from the farm to Tyler School of Art, if you can share all that with us?
Well, one of the things I did listen to was instructors, and sometimes I had a hard time listening. It's being so high energy, I guess. But Doug Johnson said, you know, you need to study outside of the Midwest when you go to grad school. And that was a really good, I thought that was really good to have that kind of influence to go to another area. You know, the area I came out of was really important, I feel, in art making itself. My ideas are always about landscape and land, people that work the land. There's something that really pulls me back there with images and people that are really don't get much credit at all for what they do because they survive. But I think that for many years and still up to the last, 3 years, my ideas really stem from the, like site-specific work, the sites that influence me, people that influence me, the kind of work ethic. I thank my folks for that kind of work ethic that to do what we're doing. Being a sculptor is really pretty tough work, and then keeping it going and that kind of work ethic, I think one's going to have that to do the kind of work that I know I have to do. You know, it's very very involved physically to do
yes.
the work that I'm doing. So it's that area did influence me, but I think hopefully now in the last few years I've kind of maybe moved on from that those thoughts.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was thinking too when you mentioned work that this process, and for our listeners to know, glass casting that Gene does is an industrial process. You're suited up in leathers, and you're working with glass that's. Oh, what is it, 2,300 degrees, and
yeah,
suited
right.
up in these leathers
yeah.
with torches, so it's hot, and it's heavy, and it's a foundry process, and your work ethic, you know, I'm wondering, I mean, I know more about your background than maybe some of our listeners, but growing up on the
right.
farm, you worked hard, and from early morning to late at night, and it seems like that background has really been a help to what you've chosen to do as a sculptor.
Yeah, I totally agree with you there. I mean, my process is labor intensive, but it's worth it when the pieces are done. Some of these pieces will take 3 years to make.
Mm-hmm.
So 2 years, I'm working on a piece now that's a year and a half. Labor intensive, I thought I was working on big pieces when I was in graduate school, but it's like being a blacksmith, I guess, but you're working with a team again too. We work
right.
in teams on the farm, and I work with huge teams. I like the camaraderie working in a team. I've got a great team. You're on the team, of course, and I've always had teams through the years to pull off my work, and sculptors in general work in teams. And yes, I'm only as good as my assistants, and I've been really blessed to have a lot of good ones. But the process is really very intense. And by that, I mean you either get it or you don't. And that's kind of my personality. I'm one not to give up. If it takes me a month to figure out a mold to how to cast it, we're gonna do it. And getting the pieces off of the pedestal from the ground up was always my big push as a young artist. of course, the first few pieces, you know, you really don't want to look at them anymore, because you know, there's weak links in within that those pieces. But I really wanted to fit into the real sculptors that were making work in the early 70s and 80s, and not have the work just be decorative. And I don't say decorative in a way that's putting that word down, but I wanted it to be have the work say something, and also be accepted with along with the sculptors that work with other materials.
Yes, you know, there is a sensibility about your work as your eye moves through it and around it from top to bottom. And that's one of the things I've really learned working at your side the last 21 years is how to look at art as a problem-solving process. And like you said, you will take months to figure out a mold, and you're determined to figure out how to, you know, make your idea come to life. And the way you do that is at the monumental scale of 3 to 8 tons. And I'm just wondering how you even figured out, Gene, going from a young artist and sculptor to how to move these pieces, how to put them together. I mean, I don't know that there's anyone around for you to learn from. So I wonder if you could talk to us about that.
Yeah,
process.
That's a good question. You know, I've been really fortunate to have that kind of background. I was telling a kid the other day that when my break from college was go home and help my uncle skid wood logs in the woods in the wintertime. And it's pretty tough work, you know, but I learned a lot for rigging. And my work now, it's one thing making the work, but then we have to break them down and get them around. And that's very, very incredibly involved in that process likewise. So you figure it out or you won't be in the business, I always tell myself. And there's times where I'll go across the bridge to my studio in Belle Chasse, 25 miles away. And I said, I think there's a song that says, you reach too hard and you failed. And there's days where I go, I said, man, I think I just, I went too far out there and I can't, and I don't know if we're going to make this piece work. But sometimes you just got to believe in yourself. I've been there before. I think I'm kind of there now with this piece that we're building. It's called Walking Through the Valley. And it's a very involved piece. A lot of people working on it. But it's all got to come together. And you don't know, you know, even by drawings and all the high-tech stuff we use, it's still got to work at the end when you put it together, you know, because a lot of these pieces got to be broken down to get into the galleries, be in the heavy metal and the glass being heavy, too. You wouldn't think of glass being heavy, be it translucent, but it's heavy as concrete. So that all has to be broken down, put into crates, and then moved on site. But none of that really matters unless the work is got some substance. So I pretty much start from an idea, and then I figure out how to build it. And if you keep at it, you'll figure it out. Just don't give up. I guess I've been too bullheaded over the years to ever give up on a piece. But I've shut down projects where I didn't like. A third into the process, and then I just didn't like it. The piece wasn't good enough, so I would just go to another piece.
Right, so you're able to change, make decisions midstream according to what's needed, is what I hear you
yeah,
saying.
You got to be careful on these large pieces because there's a lot of preparation in terms of drawings, an engineer involved in them, a lot of them, some of them, some not, most of the time, yes. A lot of preliminary drawings, there could be a couple thousand drawings going into a large project. We got to make sure we hit the target before we go into fabrication. Once we go into fabrication, meaning that the piece, then the people are working on the steel and I start casting the glass. Molds got to be made. Maquettes got to be made of the piece now. We do everything in solid stock so we can see it in space. But that doesn't always tell everything either, you know. Well, once it sits in a site and how it comes away from the ground is really important. Something big is worse than something small if it doesn't work, you know. And so we're really critical about, very, I guess, hard on ourselves in terms of how we work the glass into the metal. And then the new piece is kind of going back to having light involved in it too on the inside, just for illumination.
Right.
And in the 70s and 80s, we used a lot of neon in illumination. I'm not a real neon artist, but I had people do it to illuminate the glass, you know.
Yes.
We really question, I always question why we use what we do, may it be the color, every big piece, there's a reason that what colors we use. I'm not very much of a colorist. Matter of fact, right. The book that comes out, there's a critic wrote in the book to say that I was a sneaky colorist, and so I'm very sensitive about how I use color, because my thoughts are very humanist. And I don't want, usually, there's not a lot of color in my pieces. So I want you to see the purity of the glass and the kind of, hopefully, the work ethic that goes into these pieces, too. There's something that's a remembrance of the process. I think process is very important in what you do because it opens a lot of doors. It's not the answer to the art, but don't overlook that process, you know. So I'm constantly experimenting on the side, on work, on new processes too that are not out yet, but I'm very involved in. I don't do as much as I used to. I do a lot of drawings on the pieces. Mm-hmm. Probably should be drawing more, but it's there's always quite a bit of work to do to get these pieces up.
Well, and I think what's different about you as compared to some artists that have reached your level and scale is that you are in the studio casting glass with us. Like, you're not fabricating that out. Like, you are hands-on in the studio with the molds, the ladles, everything, the torches. And so I think you bring yourself to the pieces, and they have such an honesty and standalone quality, I think, because of that. You are really a part of them in every aspect. And that's been important to you, I know.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I worked in Italy a couple different times and worked in Japan too. But I worked in Italy in a Pino Sanretto studio, a Barberini studio. And my wife said, well, you know, they were very much Italian pieces in a way. Your work mm-hmm. is more personal here. And I think I have to be, even this is tough work, each block has to be really right on, as you know. And I mean, I think they'd have a different identity if I just farm this piece out, because that's why I tell kids the process when you work, and be sensitive to that. Be aware of the process, because it really feeds back a lot of ideas. And it's also important for me to be in there with that team dictating just working and flowing. It's really great to have a professional team, so then you can really feel relaxed on the spontaneity and intuitiveness of the process,
right.
Because it is so high tech. It has nothing to do with high tech or low tech when you're making art. It's either good, you know, to me, it's either you hit the target or you don't, and whatever the idea is. But direct casting is for me. I'm not a kiln caster. It fits my personality. It's like you either get A or an F when you're casting. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. So you mentioned a moment ago your wife, Mary Koss, and I know that you give a lot of respect to her, and your son, Gwen. How has your family supported you to be able to have this career that you have? Because I think you've sacrificed, and they've sacrificed a lot. I wonder if you could speak to us about that.
Well, as we all know, you as an artist, either you do or you don't. And I was one of those never home on the road for what? 35 years on the road doing between two studios, and my wife takes care of the business side of things. And now the book came, it's coming out. She did a lot of amazing amount of legwork, analytical work on that. So incredibly supportive, and I really mean that, because I was one of those guys that I basically still live in the studios. I mean, less on the road now because other people moving to work, but very supportive. That's tough, not easy. And I need that kind of support too. It's a two-way street. So she's, my wife is, she's a very hardcore critic now, Lisa, on the work.
So she knows that's it.
She knows. She definitely knows that she's on top of it. We're really a great team. I think my mother and dad were a great team in their business. But we're two opposites. My wife's an accountant, runs a big firm in New Orleans, and I'm a sculptor. So they always say two opposites draw. So you know, So I'm really blessed.
Yeah, and I know your sons help you on sets. I've been on sets with Gwen and some of his friends that were NFL football players because those sets are so significant. So Gwen, and Gwen's made art himself. So was there anyone else in your family, Gene, before you that was an artist? I don't think I've ever asked you that.
No, I tell you what, my son is still, he makes work, you know, he does music too. He's very sensitive. He comes to the studio. He really has a great, you know, you learn by osmosis. You could tell he's been in that studio since he was a young man, and very sensitive. Not sure if he wants to be a visual sculptor. I had a cousin, I guess, or some type of relation, that the Hauser in Minneapolis was a well-known sculptor. But my mother, on my mother's Hauser side, I guess, but not so much on my dad's side, the causes, you know. So I'm not sure where this comes from, but I know that it wasn't just a splash in the pan, you know. It's a totally involvement, and I tell students today, I might be 70, but I feel like I'm 27.
Yeah.
About when I'm working and I'm really involved. I mean, I just can't set it down. I don't have the you know, I can't work into the night now because of my age, but I'm on top of it. You just, as you move along, you got to take care of your body better. I don't have the kickback like I used to.
You know, I know, and being familiar with some of your work, you've done some pieces like Work Wagon that are homage to your father. And I'm wondering if your parents were to see now where your career is, the work, what do you think they would think?
I think that they were blue collar people. They were very supportive of the work. You know, I get a piece called Work Wagon. It's out east in a big collection. And I did a piece called High Honor for my father. It was a blowing lunch bucket. And I was at Pilchuck. The gaffers took care of that for me. That's about the people that help you along the way or be sensitive to the land. I just finished a piece called Bendora Cut, and that was done for the triennial show in New Orleans. And it's a glass and metal piece about a site that people had to carve out by hand to get their milk from one point to another in late 1800s. So, again, reflecting on what people have to do to make it in a different time, I guess. So one thing I don't do, I don't think, is just, I don't copy myself with my work. Mm-hmm. When I'm done with a sculpture, I'm on to the next one. I mean, it's history. I don't look back. And I don't, you know, the easiest thing to do is in glass sometimes is you get a formula and then you figure that out. And then, that's good probably on the dollar bills, but it's not good for the creativeness. You know, that's what keeps us going. I tell students is your work and your sketchbook, you know,
right.
You're constantly drawing. I wish my students would draw more. I'm always digging in that sketchbook. And I think that helps me draw to draw. There's an old line, draw to draw. And that's still important. You know, you can't just pull up everything on YouTube and think that's the answer.
Right, right. You know, at one of your recent shows at Arthur Roger, I really liked how he displayed your sketchbooks because they're art in themselves. You use even mixed media in your sketchbook and you tape found objects to bring out color and texture. And it's obvious that your sketchbook has been sacred to you since it looks like you started. Is that true?
Yeah, I think that, you know, yeah, I was one of those guys that didn't like to draw. And when I was in graduate school, John Clark said, you need to draw more. And I fought it. But then once I got going, I said, well, guess what? He knows more than I do. I better listen. So I started drawing and started fiddling. And I think now I tell kids, to draw how you draw, like you, how you think you can build. Mm-hmm. Or that's how I do. I draw like how I see the pieces, just real intuitively. And I just got a email flyer from Francine Judd, a good sculptor here, and she sent me a thing on David Smith on drawing, and he said drawing was the best way to get to the purity of a thought. And so if your thought is something, get it down any way possible, and that's how I kind of draw collage, and any way to get that thought across and remember it or whatever. So, but in the book we're going to have a chapter is how it's made, because I think it's important how my work is fabricated, yes, too, because that has a lot to do with the originality of the book, because I can't touch the glass, so I invent equipment and tools, so the work becomes more of the gene cost than somebody else. So the process is quite involved. And so, I think drawing is part of that, even though drawings now, Lisa, they used to make money on drawings, and now it's part of the process, and but to the artist, but not to the audience that ends up buying the work.
Yes. So can we talk about your book? It's coming out in 2018. Can you tell our listeners about, I know there's a section how it's made, which is important because this process is so labor intensive. Is this book like, say, a retrospective of your career? How would you put it?
Well, first of all, I want it to be good enough where I want to pick it up. I mean, it has to be really that, I just, like I tell my students.
Oof, I'm going to spit my tea out laughing.
No, but it's kind of like, it's like your work. You want people to stop and look at it rather than go buy it in a gallery. So, and that book, I mean, there's some basic things I wanted in that book. It's what, 3 years in the making, and I take a little bit of a credit for, but not much of it. I hired people like, Andrew Page out of New York, who's editor of Glass Quarterly magazine. He's overlooking it, and he brought on three other people involved in the book. I'm pretty excited about it. I don't like to maybe explain too much of it until you actually see it,
sure,
because
it's
always bad. But it's going to be an interview, plus there's going to be involved maybe 12 major pieces, color, kind of showcase those. And then James Yoid out of Chicago is writing an essay on it. But we're not going to cut any corners. Whatever it takes for that book to be, a strong book, we need to do. And I think it will be. It's getting close. Because I'm not a book writer, I'm a sculptor, so right, we've hired people to take care of that. But one section of the book is how things are made, and we have had a really great designer out of New York that I'm very excited about. So it should be out, hopefully. I'm meeting with Andrew next week in New Orleans on the final push on the book, and it's getting real close to going to print. And it should be out within 6 months. I know it's got to be out before my next huge show in this city, which is in August. White Linen.
August 2018, Arthur Roger Gallery for White Linen.
Correct, right.
So for our listeners to know, you'll be able to get this book through arthurroger.com, Arthur Roger Gallery, .com. And Arthur has represented you since the 1980s in New York City. What role has being with a gallery and his in particular influenced, helped, been? Like, what is that relationship like?
Wow. Well, I'm pretty blessed because my work is really tough as far as it's not decorative. It's sculpture. It's heavy. It's large and involved. When he had the gallery in New York, I was in Soho with him, with a huge show at that time, and it's really tough to. I've been into other galleries around the country in the 70s and 80s, early 90s, and some of them disappeared, of course, because of the times, but because my stuff is not decorative at all, so it kind of it's got to fits into definitely into the sculpture range, and so I'm really blessed to have a gallery like that. It's a painting sculpture gallery like he has in New Orleans. It's a world class gallery.
A major gallery, amazing facility.
Yeah, and in the where I can show. Where I can show my monumental pieces. I mean, I don't take that for granted anymore because those sites around the country, may it be Korean Arts in Philly or any of those large, big spaces, they're hard to come by. And so I've been really, really blessed on that. It's a two-way street with what we do, but he's But my work is sculpture, and that's always a tough one for galleries too, to market.
Right, to market and sell. Gene, right. We're going to take a quick little commercial break and be right back. So hold on.
Okay, thank
you. For you, you're welcome. For you, the listeners of All Things Therapy, Audible is offering you a 30-day free trial and audiobook download by going to audibletrial.com/allthingstherapy. Like I said earlier, they have over 180,000 titles available to you to choose from, like the book Before We Were Yours by Lisa Wingate at the top of the best-selling list currently. Go to audibletrial.com/allthingstherapy to check it out. Okay, thank you, Gene. So in talking about the different areas of your life, the theme of balance came up for me. You have a private studio in Belle Chasse, which is huge. How many square feet?
37,000 square feet.
37,000.
Yeah, sculpture garden, fabrication gallery, then a reference yard. There's thousands of work in the reference, like a library. Then it's a big green area for pieces to be put outside. But I didn't start there. You know, I started, this is my fourth studio, so I've been really lucky to build it up. There, but I've kept my eye on the ball. May it be at Tulane and in my own space, because it's also a learning environment, Lisa. Where when I'm working on pieces, I can walk around in that area and learn from older pieces and where it's at too. I think one has to be really content where he's working in a site. It's a small little town away from the city. The Mississippi River goes by. I'm always walking on the levee or biking to get away from the work. And I think it's good for me to get away from Tulane too, because my studio was here at one time, and I need my own time with my own work.
Yes, I was thinking of that, balancing your private studio with teaching at Tulane, which is so dear to your heart. You have a huge program. It's now a $1 million facility, and you give everything you know to your students. And how is it to balance that relationship between teaching and then making your own work? Because it's a lot to manage.
Good question again, too. I think that there's some people that can't do that, some people that do. I think I can get a lot of work done. I just don't have, I always tell kids I don't have much of a life, but I have a great life. You just got to keep it, you really have to be really focused, you know, rather than go to a party, I'll probably be in the studio. Tomorrow I'll be in the studio down the river, you know, because I got deadlines. And so I think there is a balance. Sometimes it pulls because I don't want to just, I teach because I want to give. We've been really blessed with a great studio at Tulane. I work out of the studio, though, too, and also want to encourage a young artist. And I think over the years now, I've been able to feel good about how to get good sculpture out of my students. And that's a calling, too, you know. So, but my work is a calling. My work is really important to me, too, and it always has been, you know. And I think my family knows that. I mean, the kind of commitment, you know, work and financially now it has become big business for a long time, but that has nothing to do with making art, you know, but you have to be on top of it in terms of, you know, raising the money to pull off your ideas. So that is a factor.
Yeah, you know, and you've influenced so many people, myself included. I didn't know that I had an artist within me until you took me on over 20 years ago. And I've learned to be an intuitive from responding to glass, responding to the material, as you mentioned, in the moment, and deciding what marks to make, not to make, color. And it's so much more than just making an object. I think it's a spiritual process. And so what would you want your students to kind of take from their time with you and from just the art making process?
I guess hopefully they will listen to you when you're in class, and they do, you know. You see the influences around the country and in here. I think the You really, no matter if you're a conceptual artist, you're a writer, or do performance, or you do happenings, or you do installation, you still got to be in the studio. And that's really, really important. And being in the studio, as I've always been, and that kind of keeps me balanced, is the studio environment, because it is quite involved. And hopefully, you set a good example. I always say, you know, get on the train as it goes through town, and that's a pretty hardcore line, but it is. You know, I was really really blessed to be at an undergrad school that had a lot of good teachers, and then graduate school with John Clark and in Philly, being close to New York. So a lot of incredible heavy hitters, you know. So that's been good for me likewise. So now we are one of the big programs. We have a glass center here in New Orleans. It's based on sculpture. And not just me, but other nonprofits, private studios. And it's a great city to work out of artistically.
It is.
It's an art city, you know. I'm come out of the Midwest. But this city is really special, as you know, and for me and what we're doing here. You know, students come here and they want to stay here, and that's good, you know. And since the storm, there's a whole different energy level too. Energy really keeps us going as artists. We need to be around other artists, I feel, and then you need to be away from them to, you know, get into your own world and push your own world to hopefully have an identity.
Yes. So for an artist listening, Gene, that is aspiring to work at your scale, because aside from the weight and tonnage, just the cost, your pieces sell for six figures. Mm-hmm. They cost five figures to make. It's not something, you know, that you typically wake up and I'm going to make sculpture at the six scale of Gene Koss. I know you have put day after day, year after year into building up your sculpture and your ability to create things. What would you advise the young sculptor that wants to work at the scale in today's time?
It's a good question. I just think you're really, for one thing, you get one chance at bat as an artist. And so I always said, I'm going to go for it. And I've done that. But then it becomes very real, because sometimes I've run out of money on my big projects. I stopped going out and took another job. The grants, I've got grants over the years to just plow right back into. I'm looking at a poster in my studio of Judy Paff. She said she got a $10,000 grant years ago, right back in the group. Well, $10,000, I hate to say it, doesn't go very far with the kind of work I'm building, but I'm really, that's the way I run too. I mean, everything I make goes right back into the work to make it, because large-scale work is incredibly costly to build and to get around. But I really look at the equation, and I can cut the cost down on lots of things, on rigging and moving. I have my own trucking company now, and all moving, I cut the cost down there. You can't give an excuse for not making the work you're doing. So you got to figure it out yourself. So right. I guess I've kind of figured it out, and sometimes it gets pretty edgy, but just hopefully there's enough money in the pail to keep going, you know. And but you can big scale work is had a student that started doing some larger things, and he said Claude had no idea it was going to be this expensive. But you can't really bring that up. That's what it takes, and no one's really twisting my arm to make these pieces, but they have to be made. That's how intense these pieces are, that once they come up to bat for me when I'm making them, that to finish them, I have to go through it, and that's just part of how I work, I guess.
When I think you've done well to work progressively and being committed to your vision, and you don't compromise on that. You have a vision, you build the piece, whatever it takes, however many years. You don't do a lot of commission, if really any. I know you don't want to compromise your voice and what you're creating. So I think it's a really different way that you have found. You own your own telehandler, cranes, engine pullers, flatbeds. I mean, you have everything at your private studio to move this work around, and people to help you set and tear down and crates need to be built to actually haul the glass, even just a few miles, because it'll break otherwise. There's just so many moving parts that you've put together.
Yeah, it is. You have no idea. We had to do a talk at Pilchuck about a younger artist wanted to know what it took to turn the work that I make how much it, I mean, basically wanted to find out what it cost to build it and move it around. And I've got other artists to help me talk about their careers and my career, and I wouldn't really give him really good answers because it's pretty scary. In terms of what it, the overhead we have now in the big studio, and we just put a $40,000 roof on that studio, new roof, the wow. overhead on everything for insurance, you name it. But you learn how to do it. You figure it out, and we don't cut any corners because we spend this much time on a piece of casting. You got to protect the glass. Specialized crates got to be made. They got to be made so they can be shipped, airlifted, or wherever they're going, point A to point B. Now we're archiving the work. I just had a crew in looking at the studio, and they were impressed how organized I was there. Well, I have to be because I don't really write anything down, but if I want a piece that got to go from here to Chicago, I can go in and pull it off the racks and ship it somehow. Now we ship with other carriers. We're getting ready for a museum show in Wisconsin, so that has to be, those pieces got to be pulled and get ready for shipping. So it's involved, but you learn to work way ahead on projects, how I do, and you learn how to handle, like right now, we're finishing up a major piece in the steel studio, which is not my studio, but it's my work, and then we're finishing up the glass at Tulane, and the book is coming out, so I'm juggling like four different things, but my father was really good about that in crews in his business, so I grew up in that kind of environment. Where there was a lot of things going on, but you gotta focus and stay attentive. I'd say alert on where you're headed. That's how I work anyway. But some people work differently, But that's how I found how I can manage, So you made mistakes when you're younger, but you look at it. We look at, how we can improve on things, may it be in this studio at Tulane or in my own studio.
Always looking ahead.
Yes, and because everything you do now it costs money for moving materials, not just in this raw materials, may it be metal, may it be light, may it be making crates, may it be moving the work, and then hiring crews to install and deinstall, and then equipment for that. But I remember showing in New York, and the young man said, "Who buys your equipment?" I said, "Well, I bought my equipment. That was years ago." So we're really careful about that, so no one gets hurt on sets. We don't cut any corners on it. But so that's it's my world, I guess.
It is your world. So I have two more questions for you, Gene, as we're nearing the conclusion of our show today. So I am often asked, when is Gene retiring? And so while I don't expect you to answer that right now, your position and studio at Tulane is a desired position in the country. It's a huge glass program, and it will take someone really big to fill your shoes. And what I'm wondering is what do you hope to see for the future of Tulane's glass department, knowing that you founded this in the 70s? And what do you hope to see happen when you decide to turn it over?
Well, I hope that they get somebody that's totally involved and that they really like it here, and my wife and I really like it here, so that really helps the program likewise. And this is all I wanted to do, and I'm really blessed to have that, to be in an area. It's a big job, hopefully they'll find, but also the job should be protected because it's a lot of hours to do what we're doing to make a good studio. You know what I mean?
And a sculpture program. You developed a sculpture program.
Yeah, because basically it's a sculpture program in a glass program. So you got the steel shop, coal shop, major hot shop. you know. So you can pull off all these. I have a line. If you can imagine it, you can do it at Tulane. Well, you say that, and it's a big involvement to keep it all going too, from day to day, because students are want equipment that are working. You know, we have a lot of high temperature. It means high maintenance. You know, so. I'm hoping that we've inspired a lot of people, started a movement here in New Orleans, and I'm hoping that the school has been behind me. And I know when it's time, you know, when that time comes, hopefully right. They'll have somebody too, you know, that's really committed for the not just the school but for the area. You know, because yeah. Usually the schools creates the environment for a city. You know, like Philadelphia with John Clark there, Wisconsin, University of Wisconsin when Harvey was there. So I'm sure that hopefully that'll happen.
Yes, I'm sure that it will. And Gene, in conclusion, what is important for you to leave as your legacy, and how is it that you want to be remembered?
Well, wrote down some notes here. I thought the work itself, in terms of the use of glass as a material for a large scale sculpture, and the two processes that I've developed, the table casting for the large scale work, which was done in sections, and then the wood casting. Which is two-piece molds or open-face molds, or punning out the large blocks out of the wooden molds, and then the glass program at Tulane. I think that the focus on glass as sculpture medium, very unique in the country and internationally. How I brought that up, I guess, not to boast, but then the large high-tech equipment and facilities we have developed. It's the easiest thing to do, not the easiest thing to hand out a syllabi, but you got to have good facilities so students can pull off their ideas. And then the artists who have gone through our program and are still creating glass art in New Orleans and around the country, and there's just a ton of them running programs and then their own studios too. And I could go on and name, I guess, the people.
Yes, so many.
So, yeah, so it's hopefully... in your work, you know, I'm going to continue to make work when I'm not at the university.
Right.
But that's a commitment too, about where I can work now away from the university when I'm in my own studio. Because I'm not one of those guys that's just going to quit and do other things other than making art. Because I think I'm in a really good phase now with the work, and I've been really blessed with my health to keep moving.
Yes. Is there any last thoughts you have, Gene, to leave our listeners? Anything else that you would like?
Not really.
To know?
I just think that if you find something, especially younger artists, you find something you really like, just go for it. You know. So if I turn back the clock, I wouldn't change a thing. I've been really, really, really lucky and blessed, I guess. You know.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
Gene.
Well,
I just want to thank you. You've been a significant contributor to me and my life. I value the work that I've done with you and as an artist, and you've inspired just tens of thousands of us. You're a significant influencer.
Well, you've been a heck of an assistant here for years with me, so put up with me. So I'm not the easiest person to work around, but I really thank you so much for this interview.
Thank you, Gene, and thank you for being my guest. Have a good day.
Okay, you too. Okay, bye.
Thank you. Bye. That concludes my show for today. Please join in next week for another episode, and I wish everyone a happy holiday, however it is that you choose to celebrate it. Bye-bye.
You're listening to All Things Therapy with Lisa Tahir, only on LA Talk Radio.